Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Unlimited Realities. I am your host, Lisa Zimmer, and today I am very pleased and blessed to offer you the wisdom of two incredible doctors who wrote the book, The Selfish Path to Romance, How to Love with Passion and Reason. It is inspired by the ideas of Ayn Rand. And we have today Dr. Edwin A. Locke and Dr. Ellen Kenner to our audience listening pleasure for all your desires to know more about how to really increase our passion and our connectedness in our relationships. So I would like to introduce now Dr. Edwin Locke and Dr. Ellen Kenner. Thank you so much, both of you, for being on Unlimited Realities today. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having us.
It is wonderful to have you.
Good to be back.
It's good to have you back, Ellen. We actually did part one of this interview back in March, and I was looking forward to having the other writing genius to the group, and we can have both of you today talking about how we can improve our relationships. And this was a really, really wonderfully written book. You guys really did an incredible job on writing The Selfish Path to Romance. Really wonderful. Such incredible wisdom and tools and insights. And the other aspect that really is kind of the icing on the cake here is that after each chapter, you really give us some topics and tools and some questions to ask ourselves and to even evolve through. So there's so much to learn in this book. I mean, it's one of those books that you can keep on your nightstand and really refer to it as you're going through some changes within relationships or even to improve relationships. So you're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit. We talk about our selfish path to romance, and often that in itself is a little bit of a dichotomy in what we do in romance, because in romance we're often taught through our culture to give, 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 and we discuss a lot about what altruism and narcissism is in this book. You guys really address this very well. So, Ellen, I will start with you. And I will ask you, can you define for our listening audience altruism and also narcissism, how it comes up in relationship?
Okay. I want to make one comment first. When you say give, 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 in a relationship, what I think of is trade, trade, trade. You're both trading for mutual benefit. And that's a much better thought to have in mind. It's not that it's a one-way street. It's a one-way giving. So now let's get into altruism. Altruism in Latin means otherism. Altruism meaning you live for everyone but yourself. You're not focused on what do I enjoy, what are my values, my personal values, what type of food do I like, what do I like in romance or in sex. It's just, what is my partner like, what is my mom like, what do my kids like. I'm just here to please other people. And you make yourself into a martyr, you sacrifice yourself in the name of morality, typically. You know, the good person is the one that gives up all the time. And they make good partners, not good in a relationship sense, but there's typically an affinity to somebody who's not another altruist. Two people trying to give each other the same piece of pizza doesn't work. Nobody gets the pizza. But with narcissism, it's a me-only person. It's my way or the highway. You're going to do what I want you to do. And we have a chart in our book. The typical psychological pattern that a narcissist has is they have these feelings of grandiosity and superiority. They always need attention. They just constantly envy other people and want to pull them down, but they do it insidiously. They might just say, you're doing that for yourself again. They try to make people feel guilty. They exploit others, and they don't have empathy for others. If you're married or in a relationship with a narcissist, it's basically you're living in the shadows of their life, and if you try to step out of line, out of bounds, they're going to call you on it, and they're going to get very upset with you to keep you under their control. So neither of those approaches were.
And notice there are two sides of the same coin. You only or me only are both disastrous for a romantic relationship, which is a partnership. And it's very frequent that narcissism is confused with egoism, but our view of egoism is entirely different. Our view of egoism is it's self-valuing, pride in one's self for one's moral character and our achievements, and taking selfish pleasure in giving your partner pleasure and supporting your partner's values because they're such an important value to you. So our view of egoism is entirely different than the conventional view, which is almost always narcissistic.
Ah, that's a wonderful way of addressing that and understanding it, because there's so many people who are in relationships and they really don't know where to begin in regard to improving it. So,
well, one of our themes is it's hard work.
It's hard work. It is. Relationship is hard work. It's a mindful thing. It's something to remain mindful all the time in regard to.
Yes.
Now, how do we make ourselves, Edwin, more lovable so that, you know, we can draw in a wonderful partner or if we're single or improve our relationship?
Well, it's funny that you asked that right now because I was just reading in the newspaper the experiences of a woman who wrote for the LA Times on dating through the web. And every single person she dated was a liar. And she said, "Why are you lying?" And one guy said, "Well, I was hoping once you saw the real me, you wouldn't mind." And, of course, she ended the dating relationship immediately. So I think the base of successful romantic relationships and the base of making yourself lovable is to develop your own moral character. And you can't expect to have trust and intimacy if you can't be trusted. So what are some of the virtues we discuss in our book that are critical for the foundation for romantic love, foundation for making yourself lovable by another person? One is rationality, which basically means taking reality seriously. So if you're an irrational spender, divorced from your income, you're going to wreck not only your marriage, but your own life. So that's irrational. Second is honesty, including avoiding white lies. Total honesty, the refusal to fake reality in any way, unless you're confronted by a hold-up man, in which case you should lie your head off to escape being robbed and the like. But in any normal relationship, you're honest. Integrity means being loyal to your convictions in action. Walk the talk. And this applies, of course, outside of marriage, too. Independence is your commitment to thinking for yourself, not blindly conforming to others just because your parents and friends say something is true. You still have to evaluate it for yourself. Justice, appraising and acting toward others as they deserve. We're not against forgiveness, but forgiveness in it by itself is not an out-of-context virtue. It depends on what was done to you, how serious it was, the other person's response. It's contextual, and in some cases you should probably be unforgiving. In other places, you might consider forgiveness depending on the person's response and character. Productivity, which basically means working for a living, insofar as your age and health allow it, and not being a moocher. And pride, which in religion, of course, is a mortal sin, but we think is the crown of all virtues, along with Ayn Rand. Pride in your moral character, not boasting or trying to get strokes like a narcissist, but inner conviction that you've done a good job with your life and your character. And I think if you have those virtues, you're ready to be loved by a person who has similar virtues.
And that is a wonderful guide for all of us to be mindful of in regard to what we're pulling in, because oftentimes we don't recognize until we've pulled our mirror image in of what we've actually been putting out there. So
we can misperceive ourselves. So getting feedback from others, if we're doing that, can be helpful to us. Did you know you were doing X? Because, you know, there are people who, especially in modern culture, lying is like breathing. And they don't even realize they're doing it. And it's a very bad situation in modern culture when lying is so common. And certainly if you see somebody your friends or partners with doing that, you should immediately point it out on how disappointed you are that they've broken your trust.
Right. And also lying, I'll jump in with one point, Lisa.
Sure.
Lying is a consequence of partly a consequence of altruism, too. If you're always trying to please other people, then even small little things, do you like my new hairdo? Do you like my dress? Do you like the food I cooked? If you've developed a mental policy of always wanting to say what the other person wants to hear because you think that's morally good and you're fearful of being honest, I mean, you can be tactfully honest with those things, then you actually, that selflessness, that what we're calling altruism, otherism, it helps you, it encourages you to develop a mental policy of lying to please others.
Right. Right. And that
white lies or black lies.
Right.
Okay. And you know, there's such a very thin line in regard to boundaries regarding lying within relationships, because oftentimes even society encourages spouses, partners, relationships to not hurt the other person, and a white lie is not necessarily a bad thing. And then we get into other aspects in our relationships, such as, you know, faking orgasm and things along that line.
Mm-hmm.
How does that actually, you know, start to affect and tear at the fabric of relationship?
Well, it shows a profound disrespect for your partner, because you're saying they're so helpless and vulnerable that they can't face reality, and that's really insulting to your partner. So let's start with the last one, faking orgasm. You're saying your male, if it's a heterosexual relationship, your male partner can't take it if you're not pleased every time, so you have to fake it. And then sooner or later it'll come out, and then he won't trust you. So if you don't have an orgasm, there's several things involved that you can say. Number one, said, I wasn't in the mood for it, but I'm glad you had pleasure and I like the feeling of closeness. Or, depending on the circumstances, you can say, I know you were trying hard, I think we need to work on our technique, and can I give you some ideas that will, such as clitoral stimulation, that will help me get pleasure, just as you can help me give you pleasure. So you can deal with that tactfully and honestly, and it makes your love relationship move forward when you do that instead of moving backwards.
And Ellen, what would you add in regard to that topic, in regard to faking orgasm and how to bridge that in regard to a relationship with a spouse that may not be open to suggestion, or their, you know, ego's blown, or a little bit of a fragile ego, coming from a woman's perspective?
Okay, coming from a woman's perspective, if a woman fakes orgasms or anything else in the relationship, she's going to, the primary damage is done to herself. She's going to feel unseen with herself. She didn't have an orgasm. She faked it. She knows she's lying about it. And that's going to corrode her own sense of self-worth. The second problem is that she's developed a relationship pattern with her partner that she has to lie to him. And she's going to quickly build up resentments and expect him to read her mind. He should know that that wasn't pleasurable. He should know that I didn't like that restaurant or that orgasm or whatever it is. And she's going to develop all of these other problems because she didn't have the courage, didn't know how to be honest. And, you know, in empathy, many times we've had parents who have not let us speak our own minds, not encouraged us to do that, and we've developed a lot of coping strategies, and I put coping in quotes there, that are unhealthy for us, like lying. So from her, you asked, how can she bridge it? If she finds herself lying, she can, instead of getting angry and letting the resentments have a voice, she can have a talk with herself first and say, what is it I'm doing? Why am I doing this? What has it led to in our sexual relationship? It's led to a phoniness. My partner thinks that I'm enjoying great sex and I feel like a complete fraud, and we don't have a relationship based on the truth. And
right.
So then she could ask herself a question. If things were going really well in my sexual life, what would I be doing differently? And that would guide her. She wants to do the thoughtfulness, the thought. She wants to look at her own thoughts and plan a better strategy for herself in order to bridge to change the pattern. And she will need a series of skills called assertiveness skills. We talk about them in our book on how to resolve conflict on part 6 in our book, The Selfish Path to Romance. And
okay.
She would need to know how to address her partner to say, you know, I need to fess up. Sometimes I enjoy parts of this, but I'm clueless. I need help sexually. I know that this is what feels best to me, and I've never enjoyed doing this, and I'm afraid to tell you. If the partner in the best situation, the partner may say, I've always sensed that, let's talk about it.
Right.
If she hits him in a bad mood right after he's had a wonderful orgasm, and she says, by the way, yes, I've never enjoyed sex with you. And if she hits him at that moment, you know, you're looking at the end of their relationship potentially. So
right.
There are a lot of factors that go into timing when you tell a partner, whether you have the skills to tell the partner, whether you've thought about what you want to say and think about your partner's objections. Well, why didn't you ever tell me? You need to be honest. I was afraid. Why were you afraid of me? You need to be, because I was always afraid of my dad, and I think I just projected that onto you. Whatever it is,
right?
You need to have the skills, and we offer wonderful skills in our book to help
yes,
you,
you do.
Bridge that type of a difficulty in a relationship that you want to resolve.
And there's a couple of other things here, too. First of all, people who are very religious are often very embarrassed about discussing sex, because in the whole history of Christianity especially, it's always been considered at best, well, in the early stages, as immoral and even corrupt. And then the later stages is only okay if you're going to bear children. And then later than that, well, it's only okay if it's done under approved circumstances, like you have to be married first. And it's really something that's not really the better part of you, because you're supposed to be spiritual. So people can get a lot of baggage, making them embarrassed to discuss sexual questions. So that can be very harmful. A second point is, you should find out during courtship if your partner has a hopelessly delicate ego. In other words, if they're terribly insecure, that's going to cause problems not just in sex, but in every single aspect of the romantic relationship. If your partner doesn't have basic confidence in himself or herself, you've got a problem before you start, because then whenever you bring up a problem, even tactfully, like Ellen explained, the person will go bonkers.
Right.
And cry and mope and retreat and withdraw and get angry. And you can't have a relationship with that kind of person unless they're willing to fix it. So that kind of thing, try to find out before a final commitment.
And there's also a piece where you address how altruism is not a positive trait to keep within a relationship. And in listening to you guys today and also having read the book, I see where altruism with especially women being not very confident in their communication skills and not very confident maybe in some of their ways of addressing sex within a relationship, there's a certain generational, shift that went on. Like I would say probably there's more of an openness now with the 20-somethings in communication and sexuality versus the 50-year-olds or 60-year-olds that are existing within our culture. In discussing what really stimulates them or what really is something they want to pursue sexually or intimately, and let's talk about how altruism actually can be destructive within relationship where we don't address those aspects in our intimate relationships.
Well, Ellen, do you want to start? I have something to add after you finish.
Okay. altruism is devastating to intimacy, and typically, you're right, typically it's the woman, although I've had even cases in my own practice where it's the guy. But just feeling like you have to please your partner, that your moral worth is based on whether or not your partner is sexually satisfied and with no concern for whom.
Right.
Yourself. And
for
so you put yourself on the back burner, and you get a sense of relief if your partner had good sex. And then you get a sense of what we talked about earlier, resentment and cynicism and bitterness. So sometimes women just get depressed, and what's the use? Why bother? I've heard too many women say, I could go through life without sex, but then they divorce and they get to find a new partner. And temporarily they're rocking and rolling. And if they've learned more assertiveness skills and more about the damage that altruism, otherism, focusing on just your partner causes and not yourself, then they have a chance at romance. But altruism, I want to jump in with something, Ed, then I'll pass it over to you. Altruism, we've got to be careful with that word in the culture, because the way Ed and I and Ayn Rand defined it is what it actually is philosophically, otherism, other focusing on others at the expense of yourself. It is self-sacrifice to the core. And it does not mean what the better interpretation of it in our culture means, just a genuine benevolence, holding a door for a little old lady,
right,
making chicken soup for a neighbor who's sick. That's genuinely valuing yourself if you're not living for that. So genuine benevolence is the result of people feeling good about themselves. Phony benevolence is the result of altruism.
And giving your partner pleasure is extremely selfish, because if you love somebody, they're the most important person in your whole life, which they should be if they're your partner, then it's enormously pleasurable to know you can give them pleasure, because it's not at your expense. You're thrilled to give them pleasure, sexual or otherwise, and they're thrilled to give you pleasure. It's not as though you feel this way about everyone walking down the street. They're a special, personal, selfish value to you. So giving them pleasure gives you pleasure. It's not giving up your values, but it's an aspect of your valuing. But on the other hand, you shouldn't ask each other to give up critical values, like, I want you to give up your career so I can move to such and such a place because you're supposed to sacrifice for me, or vice versa. So that's not proper thing to ask or to accept. So you have to encourage your other, your partner's values, and encourage them to pursue them at the same time as taking joy in doing things that will give them pleasure because it gives you pleasure. Now, I wanted to mention something else about sex. You're right that the attitude towards sex have changed, but not all for the good.
Mm-hmm, right.
Starting with the hippie movement in the 60s, you know, sex had, in a certain way, gone back to the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, sex was considered maybe something that people would do, but really unspiritual and therefore not virtuous and even sinful. And today, people have gone on the same wavelength, but on the other end of the spectrum, sex is meaningless. So a one-night stand has no meaning, not based on anything. It's casual, no values
right.
are involved, but it's really no better than the medieval view, which made sex divorced from the spirit, which means your consciousness and your values. So in that sense, sex has been degraded again, although from the other direction. And, you know, sex is really a very, very intimate, personal pleasure and action. And to make it just an animal pleasure of the moment, in a way, undermines sexual pleasure because it has no meaning. And, you know, the next morning, you're either completely indifferent or disgusted or empty. And to us, sex is important because it reflects a deep connection of values and a deep emotional visibility with each other. So the lessening of Victorianism has partly been good and partly not been good.
Right. And there's also this piece of casualness that it is predominant within in sexuality and relationship, where, you know, we are seeing younger and younger people having sex and really not emotionally mature enough to handle the responsibility of what sex implies. And so we've
yes.
kind of devalued the sexual intimacy
yes.
and connection that is really a sacred kind of connection that two people should share. And,
exactly.
You know, there's this intimacy. You know, you talk so much about, within the book, about how to really enhance relationship. Can we talk a little bit, and we'll start with Ed, regarding a positive emotional climate. And then, Ellen, I would love you to just jump right in on top of him in regard to
okay.
what you can add to that. How can we can develop a positive emotional climate in our relationship?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that making a romantic relationship work actually requires a lot of work, just like your career does. Most people think it carries itself because of the emotion of love, but as the researchers have found, if that's all you're counting on, doesn't last very long, especially not
right.
if it's based on limited values, just looks alone, but not character and emotional connection. So it's important to have that emotional connection between the parties, but you have to work at it because everyone's different. Even if you come from the same town, race, age group, religious group, nationality group, no matter what, everyone is still different. So there's always going to be some things that you don't automatically agree about. There's always going to be the need to understand the partner, to connect with the partner, no matter how it appears on the first date. Even on a great first date, there's a great deal more to learn about the person. So this requires a lot of communication about things you like, things you're not too happy about, things that bug you, things that please you. And And you have to, especially in cases where somebody's annoyed or angry, except perhaps, as Ellen said, maybe not right after sex, but at some point, you need to really deal with those things right away. Because mm-hmm. the common thing that happens, statistically anyway, the guy wants to withdraw because he's threatened by emotional discord and then doesn't want to communicate. And then she wants to communicate but doesn't get a response, so she nags him, and that makes him withdraw more, and it never gets resolved. It just builds up, and then at some point one of them just explodes in anger and just blows up and walks out of the house or swears or the like. So it's really important when a little thing comes up to address it right away, such as saying, I think you're looking annoyed at me. Did I do something to upset you? Get mm-hmm. at it right away. And don't let it fester because it just grows bigger. And this goes really for both parties. So that kind of emotional communication in a constructive way is extremely important. And you can't just let it slide because you once had this passionate love for the first 6 months, because it will go away if you don't work at it. And contrary to the experts, love doesn't have to disappear after 2 years. The passion
right.
does not have to go away. In fact, in my experience, if you work at it, your passion and intimacy and depth of your love increases over time
right.
rather than decreases. So, but that's only if you put the work into it.
And Ellen, where would you say in regarding to building like a positive mood or growing together in relationship, what we can do in creating that positive emotional climate within our partnerships?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to my mind is that couples need to know what we think is the essence of romantic love, which is that psychological or emotional visibility, feeling like you are the one part, you're treasured, you're loved, and feeling you love and treasure your partner and you feel at home with one another. Now, that's what you're aiming at. That doesn't happen automatically. As Ed mentioned, we learn about each other in layers. No two people are alike, so you're always going to come across differences, even what restaurants you eat at, how much time you spend with the in-laws, whether or not to have kids. There are major things that you need to focus on. If you train your minds not to focus on all the negatives, you need to speak up about them, but not to make them the core essence of the relationship. You didn't do the garbage today. You know, I told you I don't like the toothpaste container left open. All of that little nitpicking.
Right.
Instead, if you learn to cherish your partner and train your mind to notice the good in your partner, catch your partner doing something good rather than something
right.
bad, and you name that to your partner. You say, I love the way you let that when we were driving, you didn't drive like a maniac. You let that person in at the intersection in a very polite manner. I'm not used to that in my family. You know, giving each other feedback and showing that you care for one another, that creates a nice foundation upon which to then talk about the difficulties too. And you talk about the difficulties by reminding one another of the good things. I love that we have such a good flow in our house. I noticed today that you've put your boxes in my office, which I did to my husband's office. I put we had company coming, and I just put them in the office. I'd prefer you put them in your own office, and that was it. End of story. I just don't
right.
listen to the packet.
Another aspect of this. I'm sorry, Ellen, were you finished?
Oh, no, but I just need to listen carefully and follow through on it in that
okay.
case.
Yeah. Now, let's say a case where you come home on the issue of mood. You come home from work and you're in a bad mood.
Oh,
let's
yeah.
Let's assume you come home in a bad mood because bad things happened at work that weren't your doing. Now, there are a number of ways to handle that, but they're not all equally good because you don't want to ruin the atmosphere. So a common thing that people do, especially men, is they just act moody and won't talk. Mm-hmm. And then the woman feels left out, and the whole mood of the household goes down. Now, a better way to handle that is to come home and say, I just wanted you to know I had a very bad day. I had a big fight with my boss because I think he misrepresented what I said, and he didn't read my report carefully, and it just makes me feel disvalued at work. And it's nothing against you, but I just wanted you to know how I'm feeling. Now, that's a very, very good thing to say when you get home, because your spouse knows what happened, knows the reason for it, knows that if it's she did not cause it, and then she can proceed to do probably the best thing, is to say, I'm so sorry, I know how hard you work. Now, if it's the woman coming home in a bad mood, men make one common mistake which wrecks up the emotional mood, and that is they start giving advice.
Right.
Because men like to solve problems, and the woman doesn't want that. She wants understanding and visibility.
And that crosses
and sometimes just
at...
event. I'm sorry, Alan.
Yes,
go ahead.
Exactly. Yes, go ahead.
Oh, and that crosses genders, too. It isn't just one way.
Yeah.
Right.
Sometimes the women are nags. They give advice all the time. That's how they get
that's
the,
right.
That tag,
that's
nags.
Right. Now, what about, like, when a partner comes home in a bad mood, so easily it's so unconscious that the other partner will slip into that bad mood. Mm-hmm. So it's very important, wouldn't you say, to remain mindful that you're very conscious of your own mood and that you don't slip into that contagious form of moodiness that your partner is bringing home.
Point out to the other partner, to your partner, is that they seem to be coming home in a bad mood. And if it's continuous, you might say, you know, at some point, you know, it gets unpleasant to have to face that every day. Say, you know, I'm wondering, sweetheart, if this is really the best kind of job for you, because you seem to be unhappy every day. Can you think of some, have you thought of some ways of alleviating this by transfer, by changing departments, looking for jobs elsewhere? Or have you thought of something we could do when you get home that could put you in a better mood? For instance, it's well known that a very, very beneficial effect on mood is by exercising.
Yes.
So you can say, wonder if when you get home you'd feel better if you took a jog or bicycle ride or went to the gym for half an hour. Exercise is almost a wonder drug in how many good effects it has, even for brain health. So that might be another idea for changing a spouse, changing the mood, or thinking of something pleasant that they would both like to do that would make the person forget the bad mood. So there are a lot of options here for tactful and supportive ways of mood control.
Right. And oftentimes we allow these little blips to come into between relationships, and they actually end up being love destroyers and
over time.
Right. So
right,
you wrote a whole chapter on this, in fact, on love destroyers and how to fix them. So let's talk a little bit about how we can replace anger and repression and things like that in our relationships. Who would like to start?
Go ahead, Ellen.
Go ahead, Ellen.
I had one thing to say about the contagious part when you said that it bleeds into a bad mood. And sometimes the exact opposite happens. You come home in a bad mood and your partner is in a good mood, and they remind you that work really isn't that little thing that happened at work really isn't that important, and you have a much happier life at home with your partner. So sometimes the contagion can go in the good direction, too, you know, that you just train yourself to remember all the good things in your life. Moving on to love destroyers can be things like anger, things like spending too much time with the relatives or kids, or what we talked about earlier, the little white lies, or problems with money, or we talked about sex. But let's deal with anger first. If you come home and you know that your partner, if he sees that something's out of place in that home, he's going to get furious, and I'm using he, it could be a she. She's going to get furious if you put your coffee mug down on the table without a coaster again. She will just rip into you as if, you know, she doesn't have any sense of proportion, just really get angry with you. Well, first of all, if somebody's getting really angry, what's called an out-of-context, out-of-proportion anger, meaning the anger is just way too big for what actually happened. You didn't take out the garbage again? You know, I'm leaving this relationship. It really means that there are deeper issues that you need to look at. It isn't the garbage per se. It isn't the coffee cup. There are patterns that need to be exposed, and that's really hard. If a person just has a knee-jerk reaction of anger, though, and if it's founded, you want to be honest. You want to be able to say, yes, I did do that. I know you've told me many times about the coaster. I'm going to make myself a note and try not to do that again. But if you're living under, you walk in your house and you just expect anger all the time, that's a relationship breaker. What goes through the person's mind who is the recipient of that anger?
Right. What did I do?
What did I do? Or I hate him.
Yeah.
Or I hate her.
Yeah, there's that.
Right? Right. So you do both. You turn on yourself and you turn on them and you put on a happy smile and fake that you have a good relationship to the rest of the world. But privately, you're both dying. The cycle,
right.
I mean, the relationship is dead. And so you need to know that you have to be a. That doesn't mean that you have to take the opposite approach and be a wimp and be a doormat, whatever you say, whatever you. And nobody's saying what they want. It means that you need the third choice, not being a doormat, not being an angry person, but learning how to assert yourself. We have a whole chapter, as you mentioned, on conflict resolution, and you need to know how to talk about yourself without attacking the other person's character. I'm frustrated that you did
X. Unless they have bad character.
Oh, if they have bad character, you need to leave. Or if you love the person for many other reasons, but they've always had this quick temper and they're willing to get therapy with you and individually, then it may be worth hanging in there. But to live with that type of a person for the rest of your life is a prison sentence I wouldn't want.
That's right. And let's talk about a little bit, getting into kind of a fluffy area, but not really, correcting bad manners. And we started off with anger. But what would you say in a benevolent way, in a way that the other partner might hear? Say your partner chewed with their mouth open and absolutely drove you nuts. How would you get that addressed without derailing any positive connection or part of the relationship?
Well, first, I would deal with it before getting married to see how they respond.
Okay.
Because if they get angry and defensive, that's a bad sign because they probably have other habits too. If they apologize and try to correct it, that's good. But you know, let's say it's not a common thing, and I'll give you an example. When I eat, I sometimes a little bit of the food goes on my lip, which my spouse doesn't care for. She doesn't say anything. She just points to her lip, and I wipe my mouth immediately in case solved. So it's a very nice way of doing it without saying a single word. If it requires words, I think you want to phrase it. You don't want to have too many rules, but things that are really important. You want to do it in a very tactful way, such as, you know, it really means a lot to me if you would chew with your mouth closed. It's one of those things that kind of bugs me. Could you really work on that for me? I'd really appreciate it. So very positive, and when the person does it, you know, thank them and tell them you appreciate it. It can be difficult when they're automatized habits, which
right.
most habits are, because they might have been doing it for 25 years.
Right.
And changing it, and then if you keep reminding them, you know, it gets annoying. So it can be difficult. And again, before a final commitment, you might want to see where this is going to go and see if they're serious and positive about changing it.
So do we throw out a relationship if they just can't keep their mouth shut when they're eating?
Well, it depends on their other characteristics. It depends on the total characteristics of the person. If they have many, many wonderful virtues and this is their main bad habit, you could let it go. I mean, everyone has to decide that personally for themselves. If it's a symptom of a wider sort of narcissistic lifestyle, I'll do whatever I damn well please. I'm going to throw my clothes all over the floor, leave the toilet seat up, leave my dirty dishes in the sink without helping, not bathe every day. If it's a pattern, you know, that's a very negative, which you should find out before commitment. But if it's a one basic thing, and it's very hard to change, you might just let it go. And now the mouth open becomes a little embarrassing if you have company,
right?
Because it'll be considered rude by the company, and you know, maybe they could make an extra effort when you have company. So a lot depends on what their attitude is toward the problem. If they're contemptuous versus sincerely concerned with acting in a polite way.
Okay. Ellen, would you add anything to that? Or
yeah, there are definite trade-offs. I mean, when I first married my husband, cereal bowls went in the freezer. I never heard of anything like that. And because he likes the cereal very cold and the milk goes in it. And after a while, I realized that that's really a sign of his passionate valuing, that he values me the same way. He treats me lovingly and tenderly in so many ways. And he also
doesn't put
likes
you in the refrigerator.
No, I don't go in the refrigerator. But another thing my husband does that is delightful is that if he wants me to change a habit, and I've learned this from him too, there's a delightful sense of uplifting humor that makes this person feel better afterwards rather than sarcasm. So you left the damn toilet seat up again, you jerk, you idiot. You know, what do you think? I wanted to take a swim. You think my bum's dirty? And I want, you know, that is not good. That is sarcasm as opposed to, you know, a funny note on the toilet seat that just said aim here or something, or I don't know, you could play around with it. But if he has a very good sense of being able to give feedback in a way that's a loving humor. And there are more times when I just love getting his feedback because it puts such a smile on my face. I know I do something that might be a habit that he doesn't. Oh, I can give you one example. I moved in. We're back in his office again. By the way, I have my own office now. But I moved. We used to share an office, and I was juggling multiple courses in grad school. This is my defending myself. And so I would have different piles for different courses because we didn't have a lot of storage space. And so as time went on, my piles were taking over his half of the office. Not that we ever divided it in half, and to the point where I'm on the side of his desk now. One day I came home, and I walk into his office, and all my stuff is on my side. All of his stuff is on his side, and there's one of those caution signs that you get at work sites, the big yellow lines, caution do not pass or danger do not pass, that's stripped the plastic tape that stripped across the office, you know, and it was so playful, it was so delightful that there's no way I would want to move into his side of the office again. So I move downstairs. The only time I move in is if we have company coming and I have a project going and I put stuff in there. But now he's let me know, carry it downstairs to your office. So,
Ellen
so
made a, yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Ed.
Ellen's making a wonderful point, which is really, I want to reinforce. Playful, good-natured humor is a wonderful marriage reinforcer and a mood reinforcer. Not sarcastic humor, not critical humor, not caustic humor, but good-natured, positive humor is a wonderful addition to a marriage. And you never make humor the most important virtue because you don't want to laugh at virtues and caring. But on this is a perfect example that Ellen gave of pleasant humor and good-natured kidding, but never hostile kidding. And it really improves the mood of a relationship when you do this. So I want to totally reinforce. But again, you have to have enough sensitivity to realize when you're crossing the line from good-natured to hurtful. You have to understand, figure out what kind they will in fact appreciate, what kind they will not appreciate.
That's wonderful. And in addressing these little areas with our lightness and our humor, oftentimes sex in general will fall by the wayside in long-term relationships. And one thing that you both addressed earlier, which I'd like to come back to, is relationships don't need to fall off the edge of the earth after 2 years or 10 years or 15 years, that in fact relationships can actually evolve and deepen. And you have a chapter that prioritizes sex and overcoming subverters of sexual pleasure. So what I'd like to get into a little bit is how we can prioritize sex, because I'm a believer that sex is, you know, a glue for relationships. It's an intimacy, it's a sharing, it's a connectedness, it's a part of the relationship that really can help evolve the two of you in deepening your connection. So let's start off, I guess we'll start off with Ellen, and we'll start off with how can we prioritize sex, and is scheduling sex a no-no, and what can we do to overcome subverters like things that even interfere with our relationships, even children or parents or relatives. I mean, let's get into a little bit about prioritizing sex. Ellen, the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, we're getting back to that selflessness again. Notice if you're a good altruist and sex is something that gives you pleasure, where does that go on your priority list? At
right.
the end.
Right,
that you just don't make time for yourself. You don't make time to tend to yourself in other ways. Maybe you don't make time for exercise and other things, and you don't make time for sex. Second, you see it as a negative. You see it as something that's for let's just use the example of a self-sacrificing woman, something to please the guy. And so that's not going to work. There was a Newsweek cover story quite a while ago, and they showed a man and a woman in bed looking away from each other under the cover. They were under the covers, and it said, "No sex, please. We're married." And that captures that sex typically does die. You don't end up growing together sexually or in other ways, too. And partly, you don't value it anymore. Well, if you don't value yourselves, how are you going to make it a priority? So, number one, you need to gain that self-esteem that we talked about earlier and learn how to stay as far as you can away from altruistic patterns, which takes, as we've mentioned many times, a lot of work. You want to be, and this is for both partners, and then you want to have sex an enjoyable experience for both. So both walk away feeling, man, I feel good. I feel closer to you. And that doesn't mean every time it will be equal for equal. You'll both feel, you know, have what one author calls wall socket sex. It means that both of you feel warmly connected, even if one had a better orgasm than the other, or one didn't even have an orgasm, but it was pleasurable. It was a win-win situation, because when we have win-win situations and we're a rational egoist, we want more of them. And then it's looking at your schedule, and I think, Ed, you had an example of treating your partner as if they were a client. You wouldn't put them on the back burner. You would put sex in your partner up higher. And you can jump in, Ed.
And I think sex will not actually decrease and fall by the wayside if your emotional intimacy keeps growing, and that involves the mental work we talked about. And it, as you get older, the frequency could change, but not the pleasure. And it's perfectly all right to schedule sex. There are some women who can get in the mood spontaneously, and some really can't. They have to sort of plan out. And when couples are fatigued, weekdays might not work out for both parties, so you want to schedule it on a certain day of the weekend at a certain time, and then there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Really, whatever works for you, so long as your goal is to continue to have pleasure, continue to be sensitive to each other's ideas. If you have fantasies, some people don't have any. Some people do. Help make the fantasies real. Have a time to look forward to it.
That doesn't mean in real life, though, Ed. Right?
What?
that doesn't mean carrying out the fantasies. Like,
well, it depends on what the fantasy, it depends what the fantasy is.
Right, you know. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So
right.
I don't mean totally bizarre, out of the marriage fantasies. So, there's no rules about scheduling and frequency. It's just that you keep it as a value in your life, and you make sure you find ways to both keep enjoying it. And if you keep the emotional intimacy, you'll still want the other person.
Right. And children are a huge problem, because many partners feel uncomfortable. The kids are in the next room. We can't do it now. And so scheduling, getting a babysitter, or having the kids go to grandma and grandpa's, and having that as a regular event in your life where you have couple time together is critical. When my husband and when we had two kids, we still have two kids, but they're in their 30s. But when we were early married, I could have easily destroyed our relationship by always focusing on the kids. And I used to joke that my husband would handcuff me and take me in. He never handcuffed me, at least nothing that I'll talk about. But take me in the car. Take me in the car with the. And we would go to an overnight, or maybe two nights, a bed and breakfast, maybe once every 6 weeks or once a month or periodically. And so it would be a night away from the kids, but it was a romantic. It was wonderful. It just broke us out of the pattern of same old, making it a dull relationship and losing the sexuality. And I am so glad that we had these little mini mystery trips or getaways. It was very fun.
That's a great advice, because I truly believe that when you're in a relationship and you have children, you need something that is not monotonous, that it's not the day in, day out, taking care of the kids, sex in the room, the kids are on the other side, you're muffling your sounds, all of that.
Right.
So,
and your focus is on, can they hear me? Can they hear me? Which is not
that
sexy.
Yeah, just it takes away from the spontaneity. So, yes,
right.
I hear you on that one, Ellen. I hear you. I think that's a great suggestion. I'm going to put it into use today.
And the biggest,
we have only...
Okay.
Go ahead, Ed, because we have like less than 60 seconds left, so
okay.
I want to make sure you get
you,
a point
you read
in here.
The biggest risk time for many marriages is right after a child is born. Because the
right.
guy gets ignored. So, and obviously
right.
the kid has to be taken care of. But as Ellen was saying, you need to make, once the woman is recovered from childbirth, you need to make some time alone.
Right.
And you also, we want to give the name of our book, The Selfish Path to Romance. How to Love with Passion and Reason, and it's Edwin A. Locke and Ellen Kenner, and you could get it at our website. We have selfishromance.com. That should be an easy one to remember. And also you can buy the book on Amazon.com. It's a little cheaper there.
It's available on ebook or whatever you call it.
Okay.
Yes. A wonderful, wonderful book. I have absolutely loved both of you on here. This has been a lot of fun,
of
information. Thank you so much, Ed, Edwin, and Ellen. Thank you so much. The Selfish Path to Romance, How to Love with Passion and Reason, based on the philosophy of Ayn Rand with Edwin A. Locke and Ellen Kenner. Thank you so much,
both of you.
Oh, you're
God
welcome.
God bless. Have a great week.
Thank you very much. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.